in free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Thursday, July 24th, 2014. We're talking today to Joe Salerno, who is academic vice president of the Ludwig von Mises Institute, where I'm spending the week at the Institute's week-long Mises University summer program. I took part in this program as a student myself over 20 years ago, and now here I am on the other side of things on the faculty. So I actually talked to Joe some time ago when I hosted the Peter Schiff Show, which you can hear Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern at schiffradio.com. And so while I'm out of town, I've got these programs for you guys that many of you may not have heard or you may have forgotten about when I initially interviewed some of these people on the Peter Schiff Show, so that at least you guys have something to listen to in my absence. And I think some of these are pretty informative and useful. I mean, certainly I love that interview with Judge Gray from earlier this week, so I think this is worth listening to. That's why I put it together. So Joe's coming up. We'll have a little bit more information about Joe, and then we'll see at the end of this interview. Oh, wait, one more thing before I turn you over to my interview with Joe. There's an abruptness toward the end, because I clipped out a discussion we were having about an event that was going on at the Mises Institute on April 11th, 2014, and that's already taken place, so I thought there's no need to bore you with that, so I just snipped that out. So it's going to seem like I'm just saying, all right, Joe, goodbye, but I assure you I am not really that rude. So, okay, here we go. And we're back on the Peter Schiff Show. Tom Woods in for Peter. Very glad to be joined right now by Joseph Salerno, who's a professor of economics at the Lubin Business School at Pace University. He's the chair of the graduate program in economics there. He's also senior fellow and academic vice president of the Ludwig von Mises Institute. He's the editor of the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics. And it's my pleasure to welcome right now to the program Joseph Salerno. Joe, thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure, Tom.
Joe, I was thinking of having a kind of a potpourri show with you just because you've been writing so many interesting items and you've had videos on various topics, and I thought we might just share some of this information with the listeners. I already shared with them your blog post this morning or very recently about the
right.
Fed bubbleizing the economy once again, but let's start off a little bit far from home and talk about something that you wrote about last month, I think, and that's Argentina, which just seems to be synonymous with inflation and monetary instability. Isn't it obvious to people that Argentina's problem is that their currency just keeps being inflated? What is there any controversy among economists as to what's happening or what the way forward for Argentina should be?
There's really no controversy among economists regarding what's happening in Argentina. Even economists like Joseph Stiglitz, who is a mainstream Keynesian, agrees that they've been, inflating and that this has led to certain problems with the currency. There is a controversy, though, on the way forward, of course.
So as an Austrian, of course, I can imagine what your answer would be in terms of the way forward, but maybe you might describe it all the same.
Yeah, sure. First of all, Argentina has, attempted to implement, a left-wing social welfare state in which, prices are kept artificially low at the same time that spending is increased. And since it's very difficult to raise taxes, especially among the bulk of the population that are poor, they resort to the printing press. So over the past 4 years, I think the money supply has increased by something like 30% per year. And inflation, that is the increase in prices that resulted, was about 28% per year, though the government denies that and claims that last year, for example, prices only rose by 10%, which is high in itself, but it's also a lie. They rose by much more than that. Private economists have pointed that out. Now, so go ahead, Tom.
Oh, no, no, no. Continue. Continue.
What I was going to say is that the crisis that came to a head last month was that the currency was being kept artificially low. In other words, it was kept cheaper than it really was. So that is, the dollar was. So what would happen would be that they would say, look, we'll allow you to buy dollars for around 7 pesos. But in fact, prices had risen so much in Argentina that the price of the dollar had also gone up to around 8 pesos. But they didn't allow it to rise. And the way they did that was to simply continue to sell dollars from the stock that the government owned to keep the price of the dollar low, so that import prices, when you imported goods from the United States, would be kept low. And this would keep the population happy and not too worried about the inflation.
Now, back home in the U.S. on the issue of inflation, it seems like if you raise inflation as an issue, then, you know, so-called mainstream opinion will dismiss you. Like, it seems to them that the past, 6 years have shown that concern over inflation, price inflation anyway, is misplaced, because apparently the Fed can have unprecedented expansionary policies, and really we don't see much of an effect in consumer prices. So anybody who, of all issues to be focused on, is focused on inflation is really just missing the boat and not understanding that we've kind of moved on. That concern is so, you know, is so 1970s. What do we have to fear from inflation today, I ask you rhetorically, Joe Salerno?
Well, in fact, not only have they de-emphasized inflation, they've been emphasizing the dangers of deflation, that if we have too low an inflation, in other words, if inflation goes below 2% or gets near 1%, we have to worry about possibly a fall in prices, which, of course, is a good thing for the American consumer, but that's beside the point. So they're continually raising this boogeyman of deflation to keep our eyes off inflation. Now, regarding the increase in consumer prices, there is, of course, manipulation of the statistics. So consumer price inflation is certainly higher than what the government is announcing. But even so, it's not as high as you know, you would expect. The key is that much of this new money is going into real estate. We're starting a housing boom again. It's going into the stock market. Stock market has hit new highs, record highs in the past year. And it's going into Midwest farmland. So we have what's called an asset price inflation. The Fed, since this does not, you know, hit the consumers directly in their pocketbooks, the Fed's not worried about this kind of inflation. But this kind of inflation is what brings about a financial crisis, as we saw with the housing bubble that ended in 2006-2007.
You know, Joe, somebody like Larry Summers is a real dove when it comes to inflation. He's not really worried about it. We don't have to be worried about it. There doesn't seem to be much of a problem with monetary inflation these days. It's solved some of our problems and this and that. But then in the same breath, he'll say, but you know what's funny? Gosh, over the past 30, 40 years, it's like our economy has been characterized by one bubble after another. I wonder about that. I guess that has no cause. But couldn't it be that in addition to the obvious problems with monetary inflation, which would be that the widow getting her pension check, you know, doesn't have the purchasing power she used to have, isn't it also that it feeds into bubbles?
Absolutely. They want to act as if bubbles are something, almost an act of God, an act from on high. We don't see the causes. The mainstream textbooks don't explain what causes bubbles. The most they say about it is that, well, a lack of regulation can cause bubbles to get out of hand, and a lack of you know, regulating the financial system had something to do with the bubble that was created, at the midpoint of the last decade. But they don't go any further than that. They have no fundamental theory about what causes bubbles, as the Austrians do.
Now, today, when we look at economic conditions, obviously the economy is still very fragile. There is certainly no robust recovery on the horizon. But one thing that people would say, especially those who are not sympathetic to the market, as you and I are, is that if you look around at the sort of jobs people are getting, it seems like things have changed from where they were in the 1990s or the 1950s, when you'd go to college and then you'd get out and you'd get a good job, you'd be on a good career path, you play by the rules and everything works out for you. Whereas today, people are barely getting by with part-time jobs or temp jobs, and everything looks like a dead end to them. How do we account for this in a way that doesn't indict the free market?
Well, that's a very good question, and it has a very good answer. And I think that answer was given a number of years ago in an article and book by Robert Higgs, and that is that there's something called regime uncertainty. People, including and especially investors and business decision makers, are so uncertain about the future that they're loath to make long-term investments. Investments in factories and equipment and in a permanent labor force to operate these factories and so on. The reason, I mean, we see the reasons for it. The huge debt. No one is sure by how much taxes are going to be raised in the future to reduce deficits and to keep the debt under control. We also have the unknown costs of Obamacare coming up. Firms are extremely worried about these costs and what it's going to do to their labor costs. So again, they're holding off rationally on hiring permanent workers or on hiring full-time workers that they'll have to give health benefits to.
Yeah, I know a guy who runs a chain of thrift stores. So on the one hand, thrift stores are, you know, in this sort of economy, probably doing relatively well in terms of people coming in and buying stuff. But his problem is he doesn't want to expand right now because he's worried about the increase in the minimum wage. I mean, look, being a cashier in a thrift store is not meant to be a long-term career. You know, it's not meant to earn you a whole lot of money. It's meant to be the first rung on the ladder. So he's afraid of that. He's afraid of Obamacare.
Right.
And so as exactly as you say, he is holding back on all this. Now, I want to ask, now when we get back from the break, because we have a break coming up in a few minutes, I want to ask a question that will require a longer answer. So I want to shift gears and give you something we can fit in before the break. You did a video not long ago. And by the way, I'm thrilled to see the Mises Institute. I always tell people Mises.org, M-I-S-E-S.org. You won't believe the resources there. You can spend the rest of your life a hermit and just absorb all this information sitting there. But I'm so glad you guys have started a YouTube series, The Mises View, where you and other people at the Institute comment on current events. And one of these issues that seems to have, if not come out of nowhere, just suddenly become an issue so many are obsessed with is the issue of income inequality that's allegedly growing and is supposed to be a big problem. You made a video on income inequality. How did you sort out the truth from the falsehoods and the proper interpretation of it?
Well, what I tried to do was to go back to the basic principles. And the basic principles of the market is that there is no distribution per se on the market. All there is production and exchange. And I think the example I may have given in that video is if I hire a babysitter at $10 an hour for 20 hours a week, well, then she produces the 20 hours of babysitting services, and I give her 10 hours, $10 per hour, so I give her $200. So there's production. And then she exchanges those services for the money. There is no distribution. There is no third party up there distributing income, deciding who gets what. It's simply the result of all the exchanges in the economy. And what I pointed out was that all changes when the government comes in and begins to tax people's incomes, tax income that they earned on the market. At that point, when the government begins taxing, it's going to spend. And it's going to spend or also subsidize, and that's going to distribute income that's already been earned. And that is the problem.
You know, Joe, just the other day I was rereading Power and Market by Murray Rothbard, and he made a point that I must have missed the first time I read that book, but it's so beautiful. It's just what you just said, that sometimes we use this term redistribution of wealth. The government is redistributing wealth. But Rothbard says that's not quite right because redistributing gives the impression that it was initially distributed and now we're going to redistribute it. But no, there was no distribution in the beginning. There is no mechanism of distribution on the free market. There's just exchanges. There's just buying and selling. That's all there is. There's no guy with a big sack of boxes and dollar bills who goes around and hands it out to people so that when the government gets its hands on our money and gives it to other people. It's not redistributing, it's distributing. There was no distribution process to start with. All right, we're going to pick up with this and more. We're going to talk about bank runs. Are they still a possibility in the era of the FDIC? Stuff like that. All kinds of fun stuff you won't hear on Bloomberg. Coming up next on the Peter Schiff Show. Don't go away. We are indeed back on the air, but it's Tom Woods filling in for Peter. Talking to Joe Salerno of the Mises Institute and Pace University. Mises.org, M-I-S-E-S.org, is the website. Joe, I warned you this was going to be a potpourri episode, but that's your own fault for writing about so many different topics. But I want to ask you about the subject of the bank run, because sometimes we hear Austrian economists clapping with glee at the prospect of a bank run. I'll get to the glee aspect in a minute, but first I want to ask you, is a bank run really possible in the age of the FDIC? I mean, short of a system-wide collapse or something, is a bank run really possible?
Yeah, actually, there is a sort of a new era bank run. With the FDIC, of course, depositors are protected up to $100,000 per account, but the FDIC even bails out those who have more than $100,000, and it has done so in the past. However, there's another avenue by which bank runs have been taking place since the financial crisis, and that is there are lenders to banks, but people who buy banks' commercial paper, basically a promise to pay the people back in 3 or 6 months. There's also repos. A repo is simply an exchange where a bank gets money from a lender in exchange for a security, which is a collateral. These are not covered by the FDIC. When these people begin to sell these commercial paper or not renew it when it comes due, the banks then run short of funds. And when they run short of funds, they no longer can finance the continuing borrowing by their business clients. And also they have to begin to sell off some of their corporate bonds and so on. So you get a fall in the prices of all these assets. You get businesses unable to borrow. And then this has sort of a chain or domino effect, and other banks become implicated in the process. So you get a sort of a bank run where bank paper or bank promises to pay back people that are not covered by insurance begin to be turned in, begin to be not rolled over. People don't continue to loan money to banks, so banks can't finance all their assets, and you have a collapse in the prices of these assets. And that leads to a financial crisis.
Now, okay, so that's different from the typical sort of bank run that we're accustomed to, that the bank has just lent out more than it should have, and then the people come demand the money. But let's imagine that old-fashioned type of bank run, because sometimes when I talk to really hard-money Austrians, they'll say things like, the bank run is, I mean, Rothbard said this, and he's not alone, the bank run is the instrument the people have to keep the banks honest. We need the bank run. Instead of demonizing it, we ought to cheer it. Now, I understand the idea of the bank run is it's supposed to hold the bank in check to prevent it from being grossly irresponsible with people's money. But why wouldn't I, as the average American, favor a system in which, look, yeah, okay, maybe the banks are 25% riskier with the way they handle the money than they would otherwise be, but you know what? I want the security of FDIC. I don't care if that means my bank's a little riskier. I bear no risk, takes all the risk off me. Why would there be anything for me as an average American to be concerned about? I got the FDIC.
Well, that's a great question, Tom. There's a couple of things to be concerned about there, and that is, number one, when the banks have this safety net of the FDIC and of the Fed bailing them out, they make imprudent loans, and that means that resources are misallocated. The wrong things are produced, and as a result of that, over time, we get a recession. So that there can be a readjustment. So you, as the average American, suffers from the recession. You also suffer from the fact that, look, inflation in the modern world occurs through the banking system, through fractional reserve banking. So, again, as the average American consumer, you suffer from ongoing increases in prices. So this would restrain the banks from really planting the seeds by inflating that would later lead to a recession. So if you had a system where there was no central bank and no federal deposit insurance, what you would find is that banks would be very, very wary of lending a lot of money out. They'd keep very high reserves. In fact, they might stop lending altogether. And the only way they would lend is if people were willing to leave their money there for 3 months or 6 months or a year by buying certificates of deposit. So in other words, the deposits that you use every day, your checking account deposits, would not be loaned out. I think that is a system that is a sound system, and that would naturally arise if you got rid of the bank's safety net, which brings about, you know, this moral hazard that, you know, the banks, look, I'm getting bailed out. My customers know that. My depositors know that. So I'm just going to lend money to very risky ventures if I can make a big profit. We don't want those types of things happening.
Joe Salerno, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it very much.
It was my pleasure, Tom.
All right, that's Joe Salerno, everybody, academic vice president over at the Mises Institute. Mises.org is the website, Mises.org. Great events, the great summer program they have every year is the Mises University program. Goes on for a full week. This is where I first got my exposure to Austrian economics all the way back in 1993, and now I'm on the other side of things as one of the faculty members there. So it's a great and exciting. Judge Andrew Napolitano now is going to be joining us for the second straight year to teach a seminar on law, and man, is he good. You know, you think, well, he's glib and good on TV. No. He is a great law professor as well. All right, everybody, that's the show for today. Remember, I've put together a resource page for people who want to learn Austrian economics, and it's called learnaustrianeconomics.com. I still can't believe that was available. learnaustrianeconomics.com. So you can check that out, and of course, get 50% off at libertyclassroom.com, where you can learn Austrian economics as well, using coupon code Kevin in all caps to celebrate Kevin Gutzman's new course for us. That's course number 10. All right, tomorrow it's Tom DiLorenzo. We'll see you then.
The Tom Woods Show.